Today is Monday, August 2nd, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. and NATO members hold military drills in Georgia amid tension with Russia.
Regular exercises like this deter aggression and reassure the people and our allies that when we're ready, we are able to work together.
Plus, alarms bells over surge of COVID Delta variant in the U.S.
We are, in fact, in a very serious public health challenge here with a virus that has an extraordinary capability of spreading rapidly and efficiently from person to person.
Also, a second front opens in the Ethiopian-Tigray conflict. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. The Biden administration on Monday expanded its effort to evacuate at-risk Afghan citizens as Taliban violence increases ahead of American forces pull out at the end of the month. The State Department said it is widening the scope of Afghans eligible for refugee status in the United States to include current and former employees of U.S.-based news organizations, U.S.-based aid and development agencies, and other relief groups that receive U.S. funding. Current and former employees of the U.S. government and the NATO military operation who don't meet the criteria for a dedicated program for such workers are also covered. The State Department said the move will mean that, quote, many thousands, unquote, of Afghans and their immediate families will have the opportunity to permanently resettle in the U.S. as refugees. The creation of a priority two category of Afghans within the U.S. refugee admissions program is intended for Afghans and their immediate families who, quote, may be at risk due to their U.S. affiliation, unquote, but aren't able to get a special immigration visa because they do not work directly for the U.S. government or didn't hold their government jobs long enough. To qualify for the priority two category, Afghans must be nominated by a U.S. government agency or by the most senior U.S. citizen employee of a U.S.-based media outlet or non-governmental organization. Georgia joined U.S. and other NATO members for joint military drills on Sunday near Tbilisi as tensions between Russia and NATO members are rising. Russia, which borders Georgia, said in June it had fired warning shots and dropped bombs in the path of a British warship to chase it out of Black Sea waters off the coast of Crimea. The exercise, called Agile Spirit, involves about 2,500 personnel from 15 allied and partner forces, the United States has said. During the drills, paratroopers were seen practicing airborne landing at training areas close to the Georgian capital. Russia and Georgia fought a short war in 2008, and around one-fifth of Georgia's territory remains garrisoned by Russian troops. The United States named Georgia, Estonia, Germany, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Spain, Turkey, Ukraine, United Kingdom, United States, Canada, Italy, and Azerbaijan as the participating countries. U.S. Ambassador to Georgia, Kelly Degnan.
Regular exercises like this deter aggression and reassure the people and our allies that when we're ready, we are able to work together and we have the training and equipment that we need. So it's a great day, very exciting, and I was so pleased to be here.
That's U.S. Ambassador to Georgia, Kelly Degnan. With the Delta variant of the coronavirus spreading in the United States, officials are instituting new mask guidelines, and some employers and even restaurants are requiring proof of vaccination. Michelle Quinn reports.
The U.S. is struggling with a surge of cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, thanks to the contagious Delta variant. Two hospitals in San Francisco have seen more than 200 employees test positive. Most have been fully vaccinated, according to the New York Times. Over the weekend, Florida broke its one-day record of new cases with more than 21,000.
We are, in fact, in a very serious public health challenge here with a pandemic, with a virus that has an extraordinary capability of spreading rapidly and efficiently from person to person.
With 100 million Americans unvaccinated, officials are scrambling to respond. Last week, President Joe Biden announced federal workers must be vaccinated or face mandatory testing, a move some employee unions criticized as government overstepping workers' rights. Meanwhile, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, recommends that everyone, even the vaccinated, wear masks indoors, in places where transmission is high. And the attending physician of Congress is mandating people in the House of Representatives wear a mask. Some lawmakers criticize the new rule, which doesn't affect the Senate.
The CDC has become a political arm of the administration. It wants to control every element of our life.
Public health recommendations can infringe on people's personal liberty, says Dr. Fauci, but not following them can infringe as well.
The fact is, if you get infected, even if you are without symptoms, you very well may infect another person who may be vulnerable, who may get seriously ill. So in essence, you are encroaching on their individual rights because you're making them vulnerable.
The changing rules may be having some effect. The pace of vaccination in the U.S. jumped 21% last week compared with 3 weeks ago, CNN reports. The spike in inoculations is even higher in some southern states, which have some of the lowest vaccine rates. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
After a slow start, the European Union has overtaken the United States in vaccinating its citizens against COVID-19. Anti-vaccine resistance remains, including in France, where officials estimate more than 200,000 people joined demonstrations this weekend to protest the mandatory health pass. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
While many of the protests were peaceful, several police officers were wounded trying to keep order in Paris. In the southern city of Marseille, demonstrators destroyed a coronavirus testing tent, shouting assassins and collaborators. The demonstrations marked the third straight weekend of protests and were the biggest so far. Some protesters have worn yellow stars of David, similar to those Jews were forced to wear in former Nazi Germany, a move slammed by Holocaust survivors. The protesters included members of the far left and far right, and those representing the Yellow Vest Economic Justice Movement, born a few years ago.
Je suis venu exprimer un ras-le-bol général de la population.
We're protesting the government system that's been in place for decades, one protester told French radio, calling new coronavirus measures another example of bad government. The new policies aim to fight the sharply rising tide of infections driven by the highly contagious Delta variant. Among them, making COVID vaccines mandatory for health workers and requiring health passes showing people have been vaccinated or tested negative for the infection to gain access to restaurants, movie theaters, trains, and tourist venues. President Emmanuel Macron has said he respects the right to protest, but that vaccinations are an essential arm to fight the coronavirus, and that French also have responsibilities along with rights and civic duties. Unvaccinated people now comprise about 85% of hospitalizations in France and 78% of COVID-19-linked deaths. But some here are still skeptical or worried about the shot.
Soutenons-nous de la lenteur du démarrage de la vaccination.
While supporting the new health pass, conservative lawmaker Philippe Bas told French radio Sunday the government must strengthen public confidence. Like France, Italy has also seen protests against vaccines and other measures to curb the pandemic. The public response, however, has been more positive elsewhere in Europe, including in Denmark and Spain. And despite demonstrations here, polls show the majority of French back the health pass. More than half are now fully vaccinated. President Macron, who faces re-election next year, has also seen his approval rating rise in recent months over his handling of the pandemic. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The U.S. official who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book on genocide is visiting Ethiopia this week to press the government to lift what the U.S. calls a blockade on humanitarian aid to the conflict-hit Tigray region. Samantha Power, administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, hopes to meet with Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who has asserted that, quote, there is no hunger in Tigray, unquote. Ethiopian officials blame the aid blockade on rival Tigray forces, who have retaken much of the region, but a senior USAID official said that's 100% not the case. Analysts fear the war has opened a second front with the potential to worsen the humanitarian crisis in the region. For more, I spoke with Ali Vergi, senior advisor to the African Center, U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington.
The war has become a two-front war. There is a western and southern theater on the border between the Amhara region and the Tigray region and leading towards the Sudan. And then there's a new front on the eastern side of Tigray towards Afar and Djibouti. And this is the new development. And there is fighting going on in the Afar region, which the new feature of this war.
Looks like the war is spiraling out of control, is it?
I don't know if it's spiraling out of control. It's only expanding. And that's because there are military objectives that Tigray People's Liberation Front and the Tigray Defense Forces have, and they've stated those. The government forces, or the federal government forces, backed by Amhara state and other states, are responding to that. And so for the moment, it's not out of control, but it's only expanding.
What are the possibilities that neighboring countries might be drawn into this conflict?
I think the possibility has always been there. Of course, Eritrean forces were involved from a very early stage of the conflict. The more that the war moves towards the west, the more it concerns the western neighbors, including Sudan. To the east is a little bit different because both Djibouti and Somalia don't really have significant forces to be involved. But certainly there's always been the potential for regional involvement.
The fallout of this war has fallen hard on refugees, and they are, depending on who you are listening to, counter claims of who is actually responsible. But the United Nations say the situation on the ground is really bad. What are your sources telling you?
I think the situation is getting worse. It's not only a matter of refugees. It's mostly a matter of people within the region of Tigray, many of whom are internally displaced. They may not cross an international border, but they're still in dire need of assistance. The World Food Programme has said that it's having great difficulty getting sufficient food into the region, and they are running out of supplies, and millions of people are dependent on those supplies, so it's certainly a deteriorating situation.
Reports indicate that Ethiopia is mobilizing and the Tigray people are also fortifying. Do you see an end to this?
I think both sides have been very clear about their mobilization, and this is obviously a very worrying sign in terms of the desire for restraint and looking towards ending the conflict. But ultimately, the solution is a political one, not a military one. And so whether there are new troops on the ground from either side, it will still require a discussion at a political level to find some sort of resolution. And I think that is still very much possible if both sides feel that they can actually engage in talks.
That's Ali Vergi, senior advisor to the African Center, U.S. Institute for Peace, speaking with me in Washington. A United Nations overview of conditions in northern Ethiopia's Tigray province after more than 9 months of civil strife finds a society of staggering devastation of ruined lives and livelihoods. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Thousands of people have been killed and 2 million internally displaced since Ethiopian troops invaded Tigray on November 4th to retake the province from rebel forces. The United Nations reports millions of people are suffering from acute hunger, with some 400,000 on the verge of famine. Malnutrition is soaring, putting thousands of children's lives at risk. Spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says 5.2 million people, around 90% of the population, are now dependent on humanitarian aid for survival.
There's extremely limited time left to halt the rapid deterioration of the food security situation. Trucks should be arriving into Mekelle every day. Aid organizations estimate that at least 500 trucks of supplies are needed each week to meet the needs of people in Tigray. That's not happening.
Laerke notes only one truck convoy of aid supplies has been able to enter Tigray since late June. Newly appointed UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffith is halfway through a six-day mission to Ethiopia. He's expected to travel to Tigray to assess the humanitarian situation for himself. Observers say he will find a desolate landscape full of traumatized people. Laerke says civilians have been victimized. Multiple atrocities and abuse by the warring parties.
Horrific violations against civilians have been reported throughout the conflict. This includes the widespread and systematic use of rape as a tactic of war, and more than 1,600 cases of sexual and gender-based violence has been reported since the conflict began. Health facilities have been targeted, attacked, and looted. Only 16 out of 40 hospitals in Tigray are fully functioning. Women and girls who have survived sexual violence have few, if any, place to go for medical help.
Layerke says UN and private agencies are operating within an extremely dangerous environment. He notes at least 12 aid workers have been killed in Tigray. This includes the brutal murder of three staff from the charity Doctors Without Borders on June 24th. The OCHA spokesman says money also is a problem. He says UN agencies require more than $430 million to implement their life-saving operations through the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. Chinese authorities have announced a large jump in the death toll from recent floods. The Hunan provincial government says 302 people died and 50 remain missing. The vast majority of the victims were in Zhengzhou, the provincial capital, where 292 died and 47 are missing. Officials say 10 others died in three other cities. Record rainfall inundated Zhengzhou on July 20th, turning streets into rushing rivers and flooding the subway system. Video posted online showed people trapped in subway cars as the waters rose. 14 people died in the subway flooding. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Myanmar's military ruler, Min Aung Hlaing, on Sunday again promised new multi-party elections and said his government is ready to work with any special envoy named by the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
Myanmar's military ruler, Min Aung Hlaing, pledged to cooperate with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, to bring an end to the country's violence. He further promised to hold multi-party elections, but did not say when exactly that would happen.
I would like to say that Myanmar is ready to work on ASEAN cooperation within the ASEAN framework, including the dialogue with the ASEAN Special Envoy in Myanmar.
In February, Myanmar's army seized power from a civilian government led by Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi after her ruling party won in disputed elections. The military called the vote fraudulent and branded members of Suu Kyi's party extremists, but the country's electoral commission dismissed the allegation. Military authorities have faced near daily protests since the coup and a resurgence of armed conflicts in the borderlands. One local activist group estimated that armed forces have so far killed more than 900 people, with nearly 7,000 military opponents arrested. ASEAN foreign ministers will meet on Monday as diplomats aim to appoint a special envoy tasked with promoting dialogue between Myanmar's junta and its opponents.
The Australian military began helping to enforce Australia's strictest COVID-19 lockdown Monday, as a surge in Delta variant cases in Sydney continued to cause problems. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
About 300 troops have been sent to Australia's largest city to help overstretched police monitor home quarantine for coronavirus patients and potentially set up roadblocks. The troops will help the police on a door-to-door search to check if people who've contracted COVID are isolating, Police Commissioner Mick Fuller told reporters during a press conference. Senior officials have said the soldiers won't be armed and don't have special enforcement authority, but will be assisting the police. However, councillors have said that the sight of the military in multicultural areas of Sydney could be distressing for some refugees and migrants. Carmen Lazar is a manager at the Assyrian Resource Centre in the Fairfield district of the city.
It's not acceptable because our people that have come from torture and trauma countries, you know, the government officials have always been intimidating, and especially the police. You know, having the military patrolling a large multicultural community in southwestern Sydney, I don't think it's ideal for these people because they have not committed any crime.
Sydney's lockdown is scheduled to end on August 28, but Delta variant infections continue to increase. The stay-at-home orders are the strictest imposed in Australia since the pandemic began. The orders also apply to regions to the north, south and west of Australia's most populous city. Monday, authorities announced 207 new infections in the past 24 hours. A record number of 117,000 COVID-19 tests were also carried out in the same period. A lockdown in southeast Queensland, including the state capital Brisbane, has been extended until Sunday as authorities try to contain a Delta outbreak. Queensland's Chief Health Officer Dr. Jeanette Young is pleading for residents to stay at home.
This outbreak, unfortunately, is escalating, but I am very confident that with the strategies we have in place in Queensland and with the cooperation of every single Queenslander, we will get through it. Don't leave home. We know that the Delta variant of the virus is totally unforgiving. It really and truly spreads so rapidly.
Australia has recorded about 34,000 coronavirus infections and 924 deaths since the pandemic began. Just 19% of the population have been fully vaccinated. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Thousands of Turkish firefighters are battling for a fifth day against raging fires that are threatening some of Turkey's main tourist resorts. Six people have already died in the fires, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
A child cries, fire, fire, as a family drives through the night trying to escape the surrounding inferno in Turkey's Marmaris region. The video has gone viral in Turkey. Firefighters, backed by helicopters, are battling raging fires across Turkey's Mediterranean and Aegean regions, home to some of Europe's most prominent tourist resorts. Record high temperatures and powerful dry winds are hampering their efforts. Authorities have issued evacuation orders for tourists in some resorts. One of the worst affected areas is Turkey's Bodrum resort. Bodrum resident Melis Bide spoke to VOA Sunday.
Yeah, I feel terrible, Yani. We are under stress, of course, because it's very hot here. One that started in Mumcular, which is on the airport road in Bodrum, is still spreading. The others have been put down, and as the wind is picking up again, it's getting more dangerous again. Some people are very stressed, very sad. On the other hand, I was hearing party music from the shore last night.
The fires are dealing a hammer blow to Turkey's vital tourism industry, still trying to recover from losses caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. Many farmers, too, have been devastated by the fires. This farmer, who didn't want to be identified, in Turkey's Manavgat region, is traumatized by the experience. He says, I don't care if it's a car or house burned, but look at these animals. They lost their lives. They are my life. These were my beauties. These were my hope, he adds. But a calf was born in all this chaos. I took it from the fire. My children wrapped it in their arms. But its mother died. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Saturday, in a 30-vehicle convoy, visited some of the worst-hit resorts. He declared the region a disaster zone, promising compensation for those who have suffered losses. Authorities are investigating whether some of the more than 100 fires could be arson, and Erdogan gave a chilling warning to any perpetrator. Ciğerimizi yakanın ciğerini sökmek boynumuzun borcudur. He says, if you rip our heart out, I swear we will rip your heart out. If we find such a connection, there are already some indications. We will do whatever it takes. The government is facing growing criticism that the country's fleet of firefighting planes are out of action, relying instead on three rented Russian planes. Erdogan said that more planes had arrived and more were on the way from neighbouring Ukraine, Russia and Azerbaijan. Authorities say that most of the more than 100 fires are under control, but some resorts remain under threat, and with temperatures forecast to soar to new record levels in the coming days, the fight appears far from over. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a good evening.